G'day listeners, you are listening to the Natives Rouseabout podcast. I'm your host Michael, and joining me today we have our illustrious leader, Matthew Grant.
Not good. Thank you.
Today we're going to be discussing two big figures from the interwar period in the 20th century. The big fella, as he was known, Jack Lang, the influential Labor renegade. And one of Australia's most prominent Anglophiles, and he's been called a fascist, but that's sort of debated, Eric Campbell. And just to start off, why bother even talking about these guys? Well, I think the first thing would be that we still see people interested in Eric Campbell's New Guard movement today. And in the recent past, there have even been groups that have gone under that name or tried to sort of revive that name.
Didn't go
so
well.
So I think it's... Sorry?
It didn't go well either.
No, it didn't. Yeah, so I think it is worth discussing a bit who Campbell was, even if those guys maybe were not on his level. But yeah, it's worth talking about him and what the motivations of his movement were. And then Lang, I think, is a lot more neglected than Campbell in Australian nationalism. But he's also a really interesting figure in that sort of white laborist, old labor tendency in Australian politics, a tendency that we sort of like to draw on a bit in the ANA. And he's a huge figure historically, being only one of two men to be removed from office through the use of the Crown Reserve powers by a governor or governor general. So I think he is also worth talking about, especially in connection to Campbell, because they were sort of arch enemies. Yeah, they were political antagonists at the time of the Great Depression, primarily with its social and political instability. With Campbell was sort of afraid that Lang might be bringing in communism or Bolshevism, this sort of spectre, right? And Lang was supposedly more against the British Empire conservatism that Campbell represented, although I think reading some of his stuff, that is a little overplayed. But yeah, what do you think, Grant?
Well, without showing my biases, before I get into them, I'd probably describe my own personal journey studying these two figures. I actually read Campbell's The New Road book in the National Library when I was like 18, and I found it very interesting. Like he had a lot of critiques about the parliamentary system of government. And then he also had a lot of critiques about Australian culture and the way that he perceived it going in the 30s. And there were a lot of merits to the critiques. And I suppose his proposals as the kind of corporatist state, I didn't really find very compelling. Like the critiques were good. But the solution I didn't find very interesting or very very sound. The biggest things that I'm a fan of Campbell for are his ideas about like national virility and like a culture with a strong sense of purpose and destiny and just kind of masculine qualities, which he called it virility. I find all that very interesting and compelling. He also said that, any kind of revolutionary change in the nation has to first start with the individual. So like he was the kind of OG, be the change you want to see kind of advocate. But with all said and done, I think Campbell's entire movement was pretty... unpatriotic is probably the best way to describe it, because some of the centerpieces of their activities were fighting against an Australian labor movement, which were basically acting in the interests of white Australians instead of English financiers as their first priority. Obviously, we'll get more into the weeds in that on that subject in the podcast, but it's mixed, and Lang wasn't perfect either, but Lang I believe represented a more of an Australian outlook on things, where Campbell was very much, you know, he was the original 4chaner. Like he saw the over the news media the kind of proto-fascist movements in Europe and thought that was really trendy and cool and started to just carbon copy it into some kind of amorphous form of like fascist monarchism. You know, and that's the that was like the optics of it. But then even then, the early days of the New Guard were so liberal in terms of their ideology. Like it was this kind of laissez-faire, like capitalist interest, which later kind of morphed. But anyway, that's the synopsis of what I would say to get us started.
Yeah, no, great. And I think it is interesting to talk a bit about where Campbell was coming from as well, because he was a former soldier, right? So he'd fought in World War One. I believe he was in sort of the artillery as an officer there. And there is sort of a parallel with the European movements of, you know, the origins of fascism and National Socialism out of, basically the ex-soldiers who had, I suppose, developed a certain camaraderie and a certain outlook on life through their participation in the war. And especially we also have the Russian Revolution in the background. So there is more of a specter of communism than there might be today. Because
they were just the
institutional support from business, big business and that sort of thing that went behind these interwar paramilitaries like the New Guard. But before that, for there to be a New Guard, there has to be an Old Guard, right? And the Old Guard, I think, was the more secretive business-backed group that Campbell started out in as a recruiter. And I think he kind of got fed up with their secrecy. He wanted to be a bit more activist, a bit more out there. So, yeah.
It's fair enough, though, like, especially after the Bolshevik Revolution, to feel like a sense of panic because, you know, if you had seen Russia from a distance at the turn of the 20th century, it, you know, obviously with the power of hindsight, we can see it now. But to these people, it would have been a very far-fetched idea to have this kind of, you know, quasi-Marxist revolutionary activity going on. And then at the tail end of the First World War as well, like what was going on with Germany and the communist kind of revolutionary activity there. So like they were very worried about communism, but I think it's one of those things, you know, like they kind of drummed up an issue which wasn't really there. Like in 1923, Lang and the Labour Party in New South Wales expelled all suspected communists from the party, and the Australian Workers Union did the same thing. It's interesting in the history of things in New South Wales, the Communist Party only seemingly had any serious influence in some of the mines up on in the North Coast, and that ended up in some really nasty police, like violent kind of repression on when a lot of workers got their wages cut for no particular reason. Anyway, that's a separate story, but I suppose this kind of specter of like the impending communism, you know, was really drummed up out of, you know, nothing. Like in Lang's government, they introduced a 44-hour working week, widow's pensions and a child endowment and compulsory workers' compensation. And the conservative press and opinion at the time, particularly focusing on the widow's pension, was communism. They thought that was, you know, communism. It's like some of these spurgy libtards now, like literally anything that's not laissez-faire, you know, full, you know, McFreedom market economy is communism. You know, it's the same kind of spurgy crap that these conservatives were doing back in Lang's day, you know, to drum up such a outrage of a pretty minor, you know, kind of progressive, you know, this kind of Australianist practical legislation. They really went to town on it, and trying to anything was communism, you know, that Lang was doing in their eyes. It's just like you couldn't do anything right. But they definitely served that kind of business class interest, which you mentioned.
Yeah, and Lang, I mean, if you go and read what the communists or the Marxists have to say about him, they are very anti-Lang as well. They're talking, and at the time they were anti-Lang, and Lang writes in his own work, says he was, you know, facing the extreme sort of right, as he puts it, from the new guard and the old guard, and also the extreme left were trying to disrupt him as well, with the communists sort of trying to do entryist type stuff and just generally being disruptive pests, as they want to be. But yeah, he was really much more of a sort of a national, a populist type guy, and he was very much in line with the original Labor Party and its central bank of a white Australia. So he was definitely not some sort of international, you know, Trotskyist or something. It was like a complete sort of fabrication, I suppose. But on the other hand, we are talking, I mean, at the time he was more of a progressive bent compared to the old guard, which was more of this sort of like reactionary, I suppose, monarchist movement. I mean, it was very pro-British Empire, it was pro-Anglophile. It wasn't so much for the development of a native Australian culture, but it was very much empire conservatism. So
yeah, this is an extraction zone to generate income to go buy your mansion in England.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, and Campbell did go and visit Mosley, but if you like, Mosley's view of fascism was also this sort of imperial, British imperial fascism, where it was going to be about empire autarky, which kind of meant to him, I think, that the colonies would be your primary industries. So perpetual colony status, where you're constantly sending off, you know, wool and ore and stuff, which, you know, isn't, I suppose, too far off what has happened to us just with the US and all that stuff. But but yeah, like this empire autarky and the British Isles, which are overpopulated, would continue to send off their surplus population to Australia and Canada and so on. And they would have all the industry because they were already industrialized. So it wasn't a sort of a view of developing Australia and a vision of Australia sort of building itself up, developing its own industry and capabilities. Whereas I think Lang was much more along that line. And one of the most sort of famous incidents we have with Lang and the New Guard is, I think, where you have this stunt nationalism appearing of Francis de Groot riding in and cutting the ribbon with his cavalry saber at the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And to provide a bit of context there, there was a quarrel between Lang and the governor, because the governor originally wanted to cut the ribbon, you know, as the representative of the monarch, of the king. And Lang strongly argued for himself cutting it, and he delivered this sort of important speech that isn't really very well known, or it's sort of been forgotten by a lot of people. But when you read that speech, and I might just read some extracts from it, it's not sort of a radical nationalism in the Republican strain, like some people might get an idea of out of this sort of Anglophile versus, you know, radical nationalist paradigm. But that doesn't really apply here, because just to read some of Lang's own words, he says, you know, the achievement of this bridge is symbolical of the things Australians strive for but have not yet obtained. The bridge itself unites people who have similar aims and ideals but are divided by physical and geographical boundaries. The unity is brought down by a harmonious blending of English and Australian resources. The engineering brains and the financial facilities of the centre of the empire have combined with the skill, the labour and determination of the Australian people. So even just with the start of that speech, it's not some sort of anti-empire rhetoric, but he is asserting, I guess, Australia's place, not as a subject of the empire, but maybe more as a partner in the empire, I think was his view.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the way the thing was built you know, in opposition to the prevailing politics of the time. You know, in the Premier's plan, which was the kind of the federal government and the states, all the states getting together when the Depression hits and deciding to cut spending and cut Social Security and give all that money up in interest to the loans they own to English banks. This, you know, Jack Lang, you know, breaks the mold that all the other states take and finances, you know, debt finances the construction of the Harbour Bridge to, you know, aggravate the economy and create employment that would, you know, increase consumption and, you know, maintain, you know, it's the full Keynes, you know, mindset on how to manage an economy, you know, which did New South Wales very well, other than the, when compared to the austerity measures that the other states made in order to pay the crown back, well, the not the crown, the English banks.
Yeah, right, the Bank of England. I mean, yeah. they basically sent over their man to dictate what the Australian government was going to do. Because, I mean, at the start of the Depression, very unfortunate, the Labor Party has had a lot of, I think, unlucky moments in Australian history, and that kind of was one of them, right, where the Labor Party Prime Minister James Scullin had just taken office, and that was, I think, 2 days before the Wall Street Stock Exchange crash in 1929. So he takes office and is immediately hit with this disaster where his hands are going to be tied because the banks are not going to sort of cooperate with the policies that the Treasurer sort of wanted to implement, which were, I think, also this sort of get some money into the economy and do some public works and production and all that sort of stuff. No, it had to be this like massive austerity campaign. And yeah, the bank sent over their guy, Otto Niemeyer. And he basically just said what was going to happen. And Lang was basically, I guess, a revolt against that, trying to hold to some sort of Labor position where the rest of Labor, or federal Labor as it was, in opposition to Lang Labor after the sort of split, federal Labor was basically rolling over.
Yeah, cowards. I mean, Lang said, that the Niemeyer recommendations would, quote, reduce Australians to the gypsy standards of the peons of South America or to the rice bowl and loincloth of workers in Malaya. staunch wording. The way the Scullin federal government rolled over to English finance was criminal. And the best thing, all of the New Guard and the conservative press were having absolute meltdowns because New South Wales was defaulting on its loan repayments to the English financiers. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom, which had made most of its loans from the United States, had actually renegotiated its loan conditions and got better terms to basically soften the blow of these interest repayments. So the UK was well and truly entitled to restructure its debt with the United States in order to, prevent such hard austerity. But here the conservatives were clanging their swords together, demanding we make no renegotiation and just pay up, the full rate of interest. I mean, Lang said, if Britain can do it, then why can't we, renegotiate the debt repayments? But the federal government would, just cowards. It's either they were cowards or they were at gunpoint or had commercial interests in the way these loans were being repaid, because it was just, it was atrocious. Everyone else was allowed to renegotiate except Australia.
And it's worth considering where like some of these loans were, or some of these debts were coming from, because I think a lot of it was still basically from World War One war debts, where we had to borrow all this money so that we could join the empire in defense of the empire. And the government going into that was thinking, okay, we're going to win this thing. And then at the treaty, we're going to get all this reparations, and you know, they hit the treaty and the Treaty of Versailles, and Australia is getting like very little out of that ultimately. I mean, in terms of reparations, that is obviously there was, you know, some foresight in picking up PNG and all that to sort of secure our northern border, which would come into play later in World War II. But in terms of the money side of things, in terms of the debt, it was just massive. And then following that, you had pay for the soldier settlement scheme where they were going to, you know, settle soldiers on all these little blocks of land. And that was a big fail as well. Because, you know, if you've had your, you know, been gassed or something in the war, you're not exactly going to be in a state to
run a farm.
Yeah, run some farm with, where the land is pretty crap anyway. But was a bit of a tangent. But
that's right. Yeah. I mean, if any of the listeners are interested in the war debts scandals, they should definitely read Frank Anstey's "The Money Power and the Kingdom of Shylock." He was the Labor parliamentarian who wrote extensively against, you know, this kind of international finance and the, you know, the kind of banking houses and the Rothschilds who basically lent to both sides and, you know, made interest on the blood of Australian and you know, British soldiers. Without cracking open the First World War egg, it was a human tragedy, which Australia still hasn't recovered from. If you were to really think about the loss of all our frontier towns that were emptied of their youth and virility in that war.
Perhaps we could turn now to look perhaps at a bit more of Campbell's ideas, I guess, in more detail. Mm-hmm. So obviously he started out as this sort of British Empire conservative, and he developed over time towards a more fascist or maybe like Mosley type imperial fascist position. I think something, there's a couple of quotes I've collected from his book, but in chapter 5 on corporatism, and this is kind of a good one to set him up as against the labor tradition of Australia, saying, you know, one thing is definite. Strikes and lockouts must be made illegal and punished by depriving the offending parties of political representation for a term. A strike affects national production, therefore it must be outlawed. If the machinery of state is designed to give justice to capital and labor alike, neither can complain at the decision on any matter in dispute. And so he's completely against, I guess, the Australian trade union tradition, or maybe that's not quite fair. He does want to incorporate the trade unions by sort of turning them into the fascist sort of corporations, right? But
I mean, I think that's pretty cringe, honestly. I mean, you can sympathize with, you know, what he's aiming. You know, he believes in production and national production, and that's fair enough. I mean, in the Second World War, there was some atrocious strikes that were done, which basically impeded the production of ammunition. In the war. So you can understand. I mean, this is before that, obviously, but you can sympathise where there's definitely times when a strike is disproportionately causing detriment to the nation more broadly, but to universally just ban industrial action is just crazy, in my opinion. It's just, if you are going to have private property and a market system, to some degree, I mean, based on what, you know, he talks about the corporatist thing. So you get the benefits of private property in a semi-market system. You're just not allowed to have workers have any kind of collaboration that's going to cause detriment to any financial interests. I mean, to me, that's just disgustingly un-Australian. But you can understand, like, there are critiques of industrial action which are fair enough in some cases, but they're like very extreme cases. He was very much an idealist, like. And this is that whole thing. It's like, not just the kind of fascist idealists, but there's all these, you know, what sets Australia apart in so many ways is like our pragmatism. Like Lang in his autobiography, I remember, I believe it's in chapter 75, he said that British politicians always find it very difficult to understand Australian politics. You know, there's no class distinction as they know it in England. There's no nobility. There is more equality and there are more opportunities to succeed. Perhaps that is why socialism has never been a very popular doctrine in the Labour Party, and its chief exponents have been imported politicians. Australian-born members of the movement have never been keen socialists, and as a nation, we're far too practical for empty theories. We demand results. So, you know, Lang just epitomises there. I mean, I know we're talking about Campbell's fascism, but, you know, Campbell was very much, you know, you could say he's an import. He's an import in the same way so many, you know, self-proclaimed nationalists are now. Like they've been mind programmed by political movements overseas, which are just not Australian, and they're not really practical, which was, you know, I'd say a fair critique for both Campbell and the kind of British socialists, which neither of them fit into the Australian Labor Party and the Australian position. Like the Australian position was, you know, the kind of producerist kind of compromise, or the, you know, the settlement of, you know, the industrial arbitration system, where you have the competing interests of both parties acting in their own interest, but, you know, mediated by the government to come to the best outcome. Instead of this kind of, you know, socialism or fascism, which is too fiercely on the side of one party to the detriment of the nation, arguably.
Yeah, I mean, if we do go back and look at Deakin and all that, not to spend too much time, but the Deakinite settlement was a settlement, right? It was a settlement, a compromise between the Labor Party, which was throwing support behind these sort of more protectionist Australian-style liberals, because obviously liberalism in the UK and in Great Britain was much more associated with free trade. But in Australia, protectionism was so much bigger. I think it was largely because it was pushed by, I think it was David Syme who ran, was it The Age, one of those big newspapers in the sort of 1890s, but very influential on Australian style liberalism, and Deakin in particular, this idea of protection. And that fit kind of, relatively well with Labor. Like there were tendencies in Labor as well that were, you know, trying to decide between free trade and protection. But it was sort of this, I guess, amalgamation of the compromise between the protectionist liberals and the sort of protectionist Labor types that developed this Australian approach to politics and this sort of political paradigm that would hold for around, you know, 70 years or at least pretty well.
Yeah, so anyway, I think, you know, Campbell was an idealist. I mean, the New Guard, its founding platform, you know, they had two points in their platform, with the first one being unswerving loyalty to the throne, and secondly, all for the British Empire. I mean, if those are your top two objectives, it kind of speaks to, you know, their mind and their worldview. Like they're really not asserting an Australian perspective or an Australian position. You know, it was very much a an empire, you know, Anglophilic perspective which they had, which would definitely put them at odds with an Australian labor movement in New South Wales, which was trying to withhold interest payments from English banks. But it's just amazing that they had mobilized under such conditions. Like there was no threat. There's no credible threat of like a Bolshevik takeover. I mean, the Labor Party expelled communists from their ranks. Like the famous, you know, communist Gordon or Jack or John Gordon or Garden that you know had gone to the Communist International and all this stuff, you know, was expelled from the Labor Party. And Lenin wrote a filthy letter about the Australian Labor Party in the early 20s, basically calling it like a kind of conservative, you know, quasi kind of fascist thing. Like most people around the world, when looking at the Australian Labor Party, didn't really see a kind of socialist, Trotskyite, you know, bloody Marxist party. It was this synthesis of Australian practical circumstance and the belief in the advancement of the average Australian. So it's it's interesting. But Campbell was definitely, you know, I'll say it again. He was the original 4chaner. Like he just saw what was going on in Europe and thought that looked cool and just tried to synthesize something here. That's how I would begrudge him. Because it just doesn't feel like an organically Australian position. It's just like it's just hipster like foreign stuff, which is which is attempted to be localized.
I think there are a couple of things that could be said of that. Like originally the New Guard did get significant support, and I think part of this was that there was that business backing behind it to start off with, or you know, at least some through the old guard, or you know, a couple of guys coming in and giving them money. But there was also a very large segment of the population that did identify strongly with the British Empire and did not want to have any sense of disloyalty, right? So there is.
And they were also shit scared of communism, and this was during the desperation of the Depression.
Yeah, and so you had. I mean, there were paramilitaries pretty much in every state, as well as sort of more non-militant populist sort of movements. I think one was like All for Australia or something like that, something along those lines. But you had a lot of these sort of populist movements that you tend to get in times of instability and struggle. But the threat really was not from the left, I suppose, to the establishment party system. It was much more like there were even several businessmen, I believe, who approached John Monash, the famous general, and said, basically, can you take over to prevent something happening? And, perhaps fortunately he refused to do that. I don't necessarily think that would have been a good thing for Australia had he said, yeah, let's do this. The sort of scheming and concern was really from these forces of finance, these forces of big business, to protect their interests. And a lot of these things also go to show why, like, the New Guard is not a great source of inspiration for like a contemporary Australian nationalist movement, because we have really, you know, we've had the loss of the empire. You know, the Commonwealth is not even really a shadow of what the empire was. The popular consciousness is not, you know, going to have this sense of imperial loyalty or anything like that. You know, there's maybe not a lot of movement behind republicanism either, but like the issues have sort of fundamentally changed. So you really don't have that same context, and the other thing is you don't, like, no real Australian movement has big business backing, because obviously we know with the fall of the Soviet Union that the Marxists have sort of totally collapsed ideologically. You know, they're pretty much bankrupt, or like the Chinese, they've sort of moved in a more quasi-fascist direction themselves. So you know, like these small troc groups and socialist alternatives and all these things are like, they're not a serious threat to the system, and nobody even feels like they possibly could be. So yeah, you're just not going to have the same sort of conflux of influences and forces and backing that Campbell was drawing upon. Like there's just not that same Anglophile core.
Yeah, well, that's, and the other thing as well, like if you think about the contemporaries who, you know, like Eric Campbell and the New Guard, it's only because they've probably gone as far as the Wikipedia page and decided, yeah, this is heaps cool and based and red-pilled because Eric Campbell did a Roman salute and there's a picture of a dude with a black bag on his head and they were self-professed anti-communists. But, you know, if you dig any further and realize that they were basically at the beckoning call of English financial banks, you know, trying to topple the government of New South Wales, which was, you know, they actually had their offices raided after they kidnapped a trade unionist and they found, you know, a plot that was drawn up to overthrow the government of New South Wales, you know, which at the, you know, at the Lang, you know, we're talking about Jack Lang, who in his I Remember, you know, gives his 4-page defense of the principles of a white Australia. You know, this guy was by no measure a communist.
I mean, he wrote a book on communism in Australia, just basically totally talking about how, you know, it's a danger and we need to, you know, watch out and make sure that nothing, they don't get too much influence, especially I think he was writing at the time when the Communist Party was really at its height, which was during World War II, when the Soviets were partnered up with the Allies against the Axis, and there was a sort of a warming towards the Communist Party. They got a lot more influence, but but even before then, Lang, when he was in government, which is, you know, 25 to 27 and 30 to 32, when he got removed by the Crown Reserve Powers, which is perhaps another point here against the monarchy influence in Australia, because that is what actually got rid of him. But throughout all that time, he was staunchly anti-communist. So
yeah, I know he was. I mean, if anyone wants to go look up a copy of his book, Communism in Australia, it's a pretty filthy takedown of communism. If you're into the New Guard, like you're a contemporary listener and you thought the New Guard were cool, you know, just remember they were the cucks to international finance, and were very cringe. just to throw off the seriousness of this podcast, you know, if you do some reading, I mean, another academic, I think Matthew Cunningham, wrote a really good thesis on the actual ideology of the New Guard. And even Campbell himself, you know, at the very end, had really shifted towards that more corporatist, fascist view of politics. But the New Guard movement, apart from Campbell, was far more of a kind of liberal, free marketeer, anti-socialist organization.
Yeah, I mean, so the more fascist Campbell went, the more interest in that he got, the less organic support he had from the people.
He alienated a lot of members.
It was largely a sort of like a reaction to Lang movement as well. So without that sort of drama going on, a lot of people just dropped off.
Yeah, well, in 1931, they estimated the membership was 40,000. And by 1933, it had dropped to 1,500. So, you know, there was really, you know, you could argue the media played a huge role in kind of drumming up a panic about communism. Because the other thing Lang did is he introduced a newspaper tax bill in 1926, and Lang said in response to that the newspapers became an almost incoherent in their rage against the proposal to tax every newspaper that gets published in New South Wales, because the media was, you know, dead against Lang. Only the Labor journals and newspapers that were published by the union movement were sympathetic to Lang, and even then Lang was fighting against the federal labor movement at the same time, who were a bit more in favor of the austerity measures of the Scullin government. Lang was waging war against the English finance and the media, who was, you know, both of which were supporting Campbell, which is, you know, not a very good indicator of Campbell's motivations and character, if you ask me. Or at least his worldview that he was advocating, because it was in favor of finance and the media.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to, if you look at the two, and you have to think who is the Giga Chad and who is the Wojak. I mean, obviously, Lang was the Giga Chad. He's That's literally it. Called the big fella. Did some pretty Giga Chad moves, like what was it? He took all the money out of the bank.
Yeah.
When they're going to basically just like forcibly take the money and send it off to
withdraw the whole state treasury in cash.
Took it in cash to the what was it, government house?
Yeah. That's a Giga Chad move.
Yeah, pretty ballsy move.
It's fascinating. And Lang Labor caused a big rift in the federal parliament as well. But the federal Labor Party ended up getting the last laugh and flushing the Langists out of the party, which is a great shame if you ask me, because you know they had spine and backbone, and they didn't play ball with the foreign banks.
Yeah. I mean that always has been the problem with Labor, was that it was always splitting. You know, back in World War One, they split over conscription, and then. Split with sort of Lang during this crisis period, and then obviously later on they split with the DLP, which is
once again on the communist moral panic.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. It's this perpetual, you know, conservatard moral panicking stuff that sort of shifts a lot of nationalist energy, I suppose, away from where it needs to be to this more, you know, we need to defend free markets and sort of, I guess, Ben Shapiro type, Jordan Peterson type thing that you get today. It's perpetually trying to move that energy towards, liberalism. If you're interested in this topic, there's plenty you can go and read yourself. We've got some of Lang's stuff. I think we've got his anti-communist or his sort of Communism in Australia book on the Australian Natives Wiki, and as well as I think that section that you mentioned from his I Remember supporting a white Australia, you know, white Australia is the Magna Carta of Australia, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Once again, Chad moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, okay, that's all right. Well, I think we'll leave it at that then. You know, short and sweet, interesting discussion on what was going on at the time and in the Great Depression, and just a dear listener warning, you know, embrace Lang Gang and reject Campbell cringe.
Yep, 100%. All right, well, let's leave it there. Obviously, this is sort of the revived Natives Rouseabout. We'll be coming out monthly. This is our second one in this sort of series. So next one will be coming out in April, I guess.
See you then.
Yeah, see you around, mate.
We had a dream last night. 'Twas such a funny dream. We dreamt about two men we know, and it was just a scream. Now one was Mr. Lang, and I near fell out of bed. The other one was Colonel Campbell. This is what he said.
Hello, is that Colonel Campbell?
Yes, who's that?
Oh, this is Mr. Lang. Oh, Colonel Campbell.
Yes, Mr. Lang.
Why don't you scramble your precious gang? They have been a source of worry since we opened up the bridge, and the way they cut that ribbon was a downright sacrilege.
But, Mr. Lang, you were astute. You prosecuted my friend Groot. Then for doing what he did, why, the court fined him £5.
Did that please you, Colonel Campbell?
It was worth it, Mr. Lang. Well, good morning, Mr. Lang.
Good morning, Colonel Campbell.
Good morning, Judge. How are you?
fine. 5 quid. Oh, Colonel Campbell.
Yes, Mr. Lang.
Just see your actions don't boomerang. Now there's a matter in the papers where it seems that you've been lax. Though I wouldn't hurt your feelings, it concerns your income tax.
Now, Mr. Lang, why bring that up? A little quarrel, it's but a pup. And if remarks like that you pull, I remind you of your bull.
Do you mean that, Colonel Campbell?
Absolutely, Mr. Lang.
Well, how about a little drink, Colonel?
Well, I wouldn't mind a little spot with you. By the way, are you going to pay for it?
Oh, we'll have a couple of bob in on the fruit machine.
2 bob on the fruit machine. Well, jolly good luck, Eddie.
Jolly good health, old man.
By Jove. What's that? That has a kick in it.
That's the real Mackay. Oh, Colonel Campbell.
Yes, Mr. Lang.
The celebrations went with a bang. And though you sent off a petition, still I opened up the bridge. All your efforts couldn't stop me, for that was my privilege.
Nah, but Mr. Lang, you surely see. The world is laughing, but not at me. And that ribbon stunt you see will go down in history.
See you later, Colonel Campbell.
At the talkies, Mr. Lang.